I'd like to start this session with another meditation, another Vipassana practice. This time I'd like to do a little bit different than we have been doing previously. And within this Vipassana practice, we're again going to be basing it on the Vaibhashika Satrantika assertions in terms of selflessness of person, that there's no self-sufficient, substantially existent self. So I'd like to do a meditation where we're investigating to see whether or not there is a self-sufficient, substantially existent self somewhere here. And we'll use a different approach than we've been using, so I'll guide that. So let's do that practice first, and then we'll go back into the text. Finding that nice, comfortable posture, the back straight, body relaxed, and keeping the body as still as possible. Relaxing more deeply with each out-breath. Not dwelling in the past, not anticipating the future, simply allowing the mind to rest in the present moment, focusing on the sensations of the breath throughout the body. Maintaining an ongoing flow of mindfulness of the sensations of the breath throughout the entire cycle of each in and out breath. Now, do you have a sense that there's a me here who is trying to relax the body and focus the mind on the breath? A me that doesn't seem to depend upon anything else to exist. Do you have this experience? where is this me who is trying to become the master or controller of the body and mind? Where is the me who is trying to relax the body? Is the body simply trying to relax itself? Or is there a me separate from the body who is trying to relax the body? If there seems to be a me separate from the body who is trying to relax the body, where is this me? And where is the me who is trying to focus the mind on the breath? Is the mind simply trying to focus itself? Or is there a me separate from the mind who is trying to focus the mind? if there seems to be a me separate from the mind, trying to focus the mind, where is this me? Where is the me trying to focus the mind on the breath? Now, in your direct experience, what is actually here? There is the constant flow of physical change that is called the body. And there is the constant flow of mental experience that is called the mind. Yet, other than the body and the mind, what else is there here? If there's nothing more than the body and the mind here, then where is the separate me who is relaxing the body and focusing the mind? even if you didn't find the me, isn't there someone who's experiencing all of this? So how can the me exist if we don't seem to be able to find it? The me is simply something which is labeled on the basis of the body that is sitting here and the mind that is focusing on the breath. Now release all appearances and simply allow the mind to rest. Simply resting in the experience of awareness itself. Simply being aware of being aware. Not paying attention to any appearances at all. Just resting in luminously clear awareness. So let's go back to the text. Just before lunch, we were on the bottom of page 8, and we were looking at the definition of a valid yogic perception. And one of them was the valid cognition directly realizing subtle selfnesses of person. So remember, perception. Valid perception, or perception in general, has, according to Svatantrika, as its object impermanent phenomena. But here we're talking about a valid yogic perception realizing selfnesses of person. How is that possible? Because selfnesses of person is permanent phenomena. So how can perception, which according to Svatantrika only has impermanent phenomena as its object, be realizing selfnesses of person? Someone's done some study. Didn't hear? Okay, I'll perfectly 100% correct. I'll read a little bit from here what the answer is, and it's in this tenets text. It's on page 164. It says here, since the appearing object of direct perception, which this is a direct perception, must be impermanent phenomenon, selflessness is realized implicitly. So the footnote for that says, they say selflessness is realized directly, because this is a direct realization, but since selflessness is permanent, it is not realized explicitly. Explicitly, one realizes the impermanent aggregates. Implicitly, one realizes selflessness. So that's sort of how they get around it. So even though a yogic perception directly realizes selflessness of person, it does so implicitly, because explicitly the object of any perception in Sautrantika must be an impermanent phenomenon. And so here they say explicitly, where folk we're seeing the impermanent aggregates as the object. Implicitly, whatever that means, we're realizing selflessness of person. So it's a little bit of a way of sort of getting around that. So this is, of course, only Sautrantika who's saying this. Well, because the Sautrantika assertion is that if it's the object of perception must be an impermanent phenomena, the explicit, direct, the object of it, explicit object. Selfness of a person is not impermanent, it's permanent. So, therefore, a direct perception cannot be explicitly focusing on a permanent phenomena. It's illogical, according to Sautrantika. So they sort of get around it by saying, well, yes, it is realized directly, but implicitly. Yeah. Phenomenal. That's right. Well, they're saying that explicitly what is appearing is the impermanent person or aggregates. Explicitly what's appearing, but and that's what's explicitly appearing, but what is implicitly realized is the selflessness of person within that changing aggregates. Sure. So remember, these are tenets that we are to look at and contemplate and come to our own conclusion. They're not something to look at and just accept and say, well, that's the way it is. Because these tenets came about through this process. It came about through Indian masters looking at the teachings of the Buddha and coming to their own conclusions. And we're coming to different conclusions. That's why we have four different philosophical systems. And as we saw earlier, Vasubandhu changed at least three times his own position during his life. So we should also apply critical analysis to this, you know, following the Buddha's own words. You know, don't merely accept what I tell you out of devotion to me. You need to be like a goldsmith, checks and tests the quality of the gold before accepting it. So likewise here, we need to investigate ourselves, come to our own conclusions, not only intellectually, but of course in practice as well. Exactly.
No.
because they don't have the same assertion as Sautrantika. Sure, yeah, absolutely. So in Prasangika, to a direct realization of emptiness, the appearing object is emptiness. Because that's the only thing that appears. In fact, the aggregates don't appear at all. But anyway, that's next weekend. Okay, let's move on then, on to page 9. Talking about valid inference. So first the definition is, a valid inference is a new... So remember again, for something to be valid in Sautrantika, this is following Dharmakirti, this word pramana, the word pra, the prefix pra here is understood as being new. Whereas in Prasangika, the prefix pra in pramana, which is valid cognition, pra just means prime. So here, though, it's new. So necessarily, a valid cognition is necessarily just the first moment. And then everything following that is a subsequent cognition. Whereas in Prasangika, that's not the case. So here, valid inference is a new and non-deceptive determinative cognition. So determinative is sort of suggesting, again, we're going through some process to come to this cognition that is generated in dependence upon a correct reason, its basis. So here, actually, we'll go to the first and then we'll look at what that means. It says there are three types of valid inference: inference through the power of the fact, inference through renown, inference through belief. So for something to be a valid inference, we need what's called the three modes. And we're using a classic example in the text to highlight what the three modes mean. And here we have an inference. On the mountain, there is a fire because there is smoke. So for that to be valid inference, we need these three modes to apply. So first we need the presence of the reason in the subject. The reason, of course, is smoke, and the subject is on the mountain. So if we don't have smoke on the mountain, then of course we couldn't even begin to develop a inference here. So you need the reason to be within the subject. And then you need forward pervasion. And forward pervasion is the reason. Whenever you have the reason, you must have the predicate. So meaning whenever there's smoke, there must be fire. So that is forward pervasion. Reverse pervasion is the sort of opposite of that. Wherever there is not the predicate, there must not be the sign. Meaning, wherever there's no fire, there can't be smoke. There's no smoke. So if you have those three modes, then we have as a correct inference. And we have three types of inference here, through the power of the fact, which is sort of, this is sort of an example of that. Inference through renown, inference through belief. So the first one, it says, an illustration of an inference through the power of the fact is an inference that realizes sound to be impermanent due to the reason that it is a product. So again, we have the three modes there, that the presence of the reason in the subject. So we have that the product is within sound is a product. So product is part of understanding. So we have to understand that, of course, sound is a product as part of that. And then we have to understand that whatever is a product must be impermanent, and whatever is not impermanent can't be a product. And we can then have that valid inference. And then we have inference through renown. Here it says it's an illustration of inference through renown is an inference that realizes that rabbit bearer, I think that used to be another name for the moon, because I think in the old days when you looked at the moon, it looks like there was a rabbit in the moon. So that was a sort of another term for the moon. It was a rabbit bearer. to be called by the term moon through the reason exists among objects of conception. So I think this is a very simple sort of inference in terms of simply just using different conception or different idea for the same thing. And then inference through belief. So remember we talked about there were three types of phenomena early on. There's the manifest phenomena, which we can know through direct perception, so valid perception. Then we have slightly hidden phenomena, which we can know through inference through the power of the fact. We can use this reasoning and logic to establish its existence. And then we have the extremely hidden phenomena, which this falls into the category of, and we have the illustration of that. An inference through inference through belief is an inference that realizes scripture, and the example is due to generosity comes wealth, due to ethics comes happiness, and so on. So this is really the sort of subtle workings of karma, is non-deceptive with respect to the meaning indicated by it through the reason that it is completely reliable scripture by the threefold investigation. So here, even though we can't use through the power of the fact, through this sort of reasoning, we can use it through authority. And so it says it's by the threefold investigation, meaning that if it's not contradicted by direct perception, by inference, or other scriptures, then it's said to comply with the authoritative scripture. So then it's said to be a type of inference. And that is this one here, inference through belief or through authority. Yeah, it's how they're realized. Right, the first one is that if we're going to use a reason, that needs to be present in what we're trying to prove. Whereas forward and reverse privation is between the predicate and the sign, the reason. So the first one is the connection between the reason and the subject. And actually, yeah, I mean, if there's no smoke on the mountain, then how can you prove there's fire? Of course, if you can directly see it. But if you can't see smoke on the fire on the mountain, then there's no way of proving the fire exists there through this. Yeah, and in fact, this comes up a little bit later over the page where we talk about... where is it? correct assumption. If we don't have this, then we can maybe have correct assumption that on the mountain there is a fire. So that might be true. We might say on the mountain there's a fire, but we haven't. And there can be a number of ways that's a correct assumption. Yeah, and there's a number of ways that it can be incomplete, which is coming up next page. Okay. Going on, it says, an inference through renown is necessarily an inference through the power of the fact. And here it says, if it is a perception, it is not necessarily a valid perception. Sorry? So I didn't catch what you said. An inference through renown is that second example. They're just saying that actually is actually the same as through the power of the fact. That's all. If it is a perception, it is not necessarily a valid perception. Why? Second moment of a perception is a subsequent cognition. If it is an inference, it is not necessarily a valid inference. because the second moment of sense perception apprehending form, and the second moment of inference realizing sound to be impermanent are subsequent cognition. So it's a little technical point. Again, it's because of within the Sautrantikas, the understanding of pra in pramana, invalid cognition, just means new. Whereas in Prasangika, they wouldn't accept that. They would say the second moment is still a valid perception or valid cognition, because for them, pramana doesn't mean new, doesn't necessarily have to be new, it just means prime. Okay. And then there's a quote from a text quoting a commentary on Dharmakirti with regard to that. The first moment of perception, the first moment of inference are valid cognitions. Latter moments of these cognitions, since they are not different in terms of establishment and abiding, being continuum of those, are not valid cognitions. So that's fairly straightforward, I think. So now let's go look at non-valid cognition. It's a cognition that is not new and non-deceptive. So not new then covers subsequent cognition, and not non-deceptive would be all the others would be covered under for that. So there are five types of non-valid cognition: the subsequent cognition, wrong consciousness, doubt, correct assumption, and inattentive awareness. So I think most of this is fairly straightforward, so we'll just sort of go through it and see if there's anything that comes up. So subsequent cognition, a definition, a cognition that realizes that which has already been realized. So I think that's fairly straightforward. There are two types of subsequent cognitions, conceptual and non-conceptual. And so some examples of conceptual subsequent cognitions is a remembering consciousness, remembering blue, that is generated through being induced by a sense perception apprehending blue. And the second moment of an inference realizing sound to be impermanent. So both of those are conceptual cognitions, and they're subsequent cognitions because they're a continuation of what was realized previously. And an example of a non-conceptual subsequent cognition is the second moment of a sense perception apprehending form. So again, I think that's fairly straightforward. And then if we look at what is wrong consciousness, is defined as a cognition that engages its object mistakenly. Again, there are two types of wrong consciousnesses, like subsequent cognitions. There's conceptual and non-conceptual. Example of a conceptual wrong consciousness is a conception apprehending sound to be permanent. So that's a wrong consciousness, and it's conceptual. Examples of non-conceptual wrong consciousnesses, a sense consciousness to which one moon appears as two moons, and a sense consciousness to which a snow mountain appears as blue. So these are often fairly classical examples that are given in these sort of texts when we talk about wrong consciousnesses. So again, I think that's fairly straightforward. Definition of doubt. And doubt is, we looked earlier at a one way of dividing up mind into main mind mental factors, and we had those 51 mental factors, and doubt is one of those 51 mental factors. And the definition here is it's a mental factor that by its own force hesitates with respect to two alternatives. And then the next sentence actually really doesn't say much. It just sort of says, yes, it's a mental factor. But to go through the sentence, it says, a mental consciousness that is concomitant with doubt and the accompanying feelings are not that which by its own force hesitates with respect to two alternatives, because they hesitate with respect to two alternatives due to the force of that doubt. So it's just really saying that doubt is a mental factor, and it's not the consciousness itself. That when we have that mental factor, of course it's concomitant, it comes together with what's called the main mind, but here we're saying that it's not the main mind that is the hesitates by its own force, it's that mental factor that is that. So it's not really saying very much, that sentence, I think. Then it says there are three types of doubt: doubt tending toward the fact, doubt tending away from the fact and equal doubt. And so this is often described as how, you know, with these non-valid cognitions, how we sort of move from initially from wrong consciousness, and then often it's said from a wrong consciousness where we actively see things in the wrong way, then the next step to moving in the right direction is we have doubt tending away from the fact, meaning we still accept that things are wrong, but maybe, and in fact, we got an example here. A doubt tending away from the fact is a doubt that thinks sound is probably permanent. So the wrong consciousness would be sound is permanent. Then a little bit of doubt creeps in, but we think probably sound's impermanent. And then we go to the next step where's equal doubt, where it says thinks sound could be permanent, impermanent, not sure. And then we get a little bit more convinced that we have a doubt tending toward the fact that sound is probably impermanent. And then actually the next step is coming up in the next one is correct assumption. Then we correctly assume sound is impermanent without realizing it, without going through some sort of inference. We just correctly assume that sound is impermanent. So we have those sort of three variations of doubt that we can often go through when we go from wrong consciousness through to correct assumption and through to valid cognition. So then if we go on to the correct assumption, and here there are five types of correct assumption. It's a determinative cognition that accords with the fact but deceptively determines its object. So we haven't got the three modes so that we are non-deceptive with respect to the object, not knowing the object because we have those three modes. And so let's have a look at each one of those five. And again, I think they're all fairly straightforward, but let's see if there's any confusion. So the first is correct assumption without a reason. So an awareness apprehending sound to be impermanent in dependence on the mere words sound is impermanent is an illustration of a correct assumption without a reason, because the words sound is impermanent express the thesis that sound is impermanent, but a correct reason why sound is impermanent has not been stated. So that's straightforward, that we just accept sound is impermanent without understanding, without reason. And then there's the correct assumption with a contradictory reason. So the example here is an awareness apprehending sound to be impermanent due to the reason of its being empty of ability to perform a function is an illustration of a correct assumption with contradictory reason, because being empty of ability to perform a function is contradictory with sound. So of course sound can perform a function. So if we say sound is impermanent because it can't perform a function, this is a contradictory reason. And then if we continue on to the top of page 11, an awareness apprehending sound to be impermanent due to the reason of its being an object of comprehension is an illustration of a correct assumption with an indefinite reason, because being an object of comprehension is an indefinite reason for establishing sound to be impermanent. So it's indefinite because object of comprehension is a synonym for existent. And so existence can either be permanent or impermanent. So therefore, giving the reason of object of comprehension is indefinite with respect to proving that sound is impermanent. And then the fourth one is a correct assumption with an inapplicable reason, meaning a reason that does not apply to the subject. And so again, I think this one is fairly straightforward, but let's look at it. An awareness apprehending sound to be impermanent due to the reason of its being an object of apprehension of eye consciousness is an illustration of a correct assumption with an inapplicable reason, because being an object of apprehension of eye consciousness is an inapplicable reason in proving that sound is impermanent, because that reason does not apply to the subject, that it's that sound is not an object of eye consciousness. So it's an inapplicable reason. And then the last one And this really relates to these three modes, to the first point, is an awareness apprehending sound to be impermanent due to the reason of its being a product in the continuum of a person who has not ascertained with valid cognition that sound is a product is an illustration of a correct assumption with a correct but undetermined reason, because although being a product is a correct reason to establish that sound is impermanent, that correct reason has not been determined by that person. So the fact that sound is impermanent because it's a product is a valid reason, but if we have not established through valid cognition that sound is a product, then we can't use that as a reason. A little bit like this. If we haven't established that there's smoke on the mountain, then we can't use that as a reason to prove that there's fire on the mountain, because we haven't established that, because maybe we haven't seen the smoke. It's like that here. So it is a correct reasoning, but only if we have established the reason in the subject. If we, in this case, if we have established that sound is a product, then we can use that. So again, I think that's fairly straightforward. Any questions about correct assumption? Talking about? Yeah. Okay. You can remove your superimpositions and get to the question. Okay. About doubt. I think in the normal presentation here, based on Dharmakirti's work, then doubt is a mental factor. It's one of the 51. I think it's the one of the four indeterminate. It can either be virtuous or non-virtuous. Yeah, but remember, it's concomitant with the main mind. I think what they're suggesting here is that it's by its own force, it's the mental factor. But of course, you can't have that mental factor floating around. It has to be together with the main mind always. Yeah. So I think it's just highlighting that the wavering is due to the mental factor. That's all. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So non-deceptive is basically this. Is that non-deceptive means we need to really have the three modes for it to be non-deceptive. Because correct assumption doesn't have this. We don't have this three modes in a correct assumption. Either because we don't have a reason for all those five. Either we don't have a reason, we have a contradictory reason, so we haven't realized it because we don't have the three modes. We don't have a correct reason and we haven't established the three modes. If we establish the three modes, for us it's non-deceptive, we know it. Before that, we happened to get it right. We sort of, you know, somehow someone told us sound is impermanent. We go, oh yeah, that sounds good, I'll believe that. That's a correct assumption. But if we have that, then it's for us, it's non-deceptive. It's not like someone can come along and then somehow talk us out of it. But with correct assumption, then of course that could happen. Okay. Let's move on. We'll just finish this inattentive perception, and then it's time for another tea break. So inattentive perception is non-mistaken cognition that has a clear appearance of its object but does not ascertain it. So often we talk about we need a minimum number of moments of appearing object for it to be ascertained. If we have less than that, then we have what's called inattentive perception. And there are some examples here. It says there are three types of inattentive perception: inattentive sense perception, inattentive mental perception, inattentive self-cognizing perception. So an inattentive sense perception is an ear consciousness apprehending sound at the time the eyes are engrossed in a beautiful form. So again, there is sound appearing, but because the mind is engaged in another object, in this case we're engrossed in some visual object, then we don't pick up the sound. Examples of inattentive mental perception are mental perceptions in a continuum of an ordinary being that apprehend the five objects, form, and so forth. Because remember here, the mental perception in an ordinary being is one moment at the end of a sense perception. So it's inattentive. So we see something visual or any sense object, and then at the end of that, we have one moment of mental perception, and then the next moment it's conceptual. So that one moment of direct mental perception in an ordinary being, of course, is inattentive. It's not enough for us to be aware of it. So that's the example given here. Examples of inattentive self-cognizing perception are self-cognitions in the continuum of an ordinary being that experience mental perceptions apprehending the five objects, form, and so forth. So, of course, in Saltrantika, who accepts self-cognizers, then, of course, at the time of we have that mental perception, one moment of mental perception of the object, we have one moment of self-cognizing perception. And again, it's not enough, and therefore it's inattentive. Okay. In general, there are three types of object possessors: being, speech, and valid cognitions. There are three types of valid object possessors: valid persons, valid speech, and valid consciousnesses. And then an example of each of those: a valid person is said to be the teacher, Shakyamuni Buddha. Valid speech is said to be the turning of the wheel of the Dharma, of the Four Noble Truths. And examples of valid consciousnesses are valid perceptions and valid inferences. So that's what we've just been looking at: valid perception, valid inference. Yeah, I think here, because valid cognition is coming from pramana, the word pramana, and there pra is sort of new, but I think here we're not using that etymology of pramana. Yeah, I guess it just means true. Although of course, here, when we talk about valid consciousnesses or valid perceptions and valid inference, then valid perceptions and valid inferences, according to Sautrantika, are new. In that case, they are new because we're talking about cognition. But in the two previous, we're talking about person and speech, so we're not talking about the first moment of cognition. So what criteria, valid person, valid speech, probably means true or accurate, something like that. Any other questions about any of this section about valid, non-valid mind? Okay, then let's have a tea break, and we'll come back and have a look at the last part of the Sautrantika's assertion of selflessness and traversing the paths. And there's not much here in the text, and most of their assertions in this regard are fairly similar to Vaibhashika's, but there are a few small differences we'll look at in the next session. And then we'll do a little bit of a summary of the Vaibhashika Satrantika. And if we get a little bit of time, I might mention a few things about Chittamatra Majjhamika as a bit of a preview for next week. But first, a cup of tea.